Tonight we have another person who I just, the first time I heard him, he was here at 164 Group. And by the way, my name's Toby and I'm still an alcoholic. You know, there's some people that strike you by the words that they say and the way they say it, and that they come from the heart and they genuinely mean what they're saying. And when I heard this guy speak, it's like, I gotta hear a story. I wanna hear what he has to say. I like what he has to say. Seemed like he was coming from the book, that he'd actually done the steps, and that I think we could all learn from the message that he has. And with that, it's my privilege to introduce David Kay.
So I just speak right into the, it's ready to go. Hey guys, my name is Dave King. I'm a drunk and a junkie. And my sobriety date is September 24th of 2000. It was not my design in life to become an alcoholic, that's for sure. Here I am, and I can't think of a better place to be right now, which isn't the way I thought for sure growing up. My life was nuts way before I ever picked up my first drink. I had spinal meningitis when I was like 3. I lost both my parents pretty young. My mom was killed by a drunk driver. I was certain I would never drive drunk. My dad killed himself drinking. I thought he was an idiot. My grandparents, both my grandfathers, killed themselves drinking. My grandmother died on drugs at a house after I got sober, where I got to take care of her for the last 10 days of her life, which was pretty amazing for me. That's one of the benefits of having been around for a little while. I was in a car accident that killed my mom, and I broke every bone in my face and was unconscious for like 3 weeks. I had serious sexual trauma when I was 8 years old that crippled me mentally till I was about 17, because I suppressed it, forgot a lot about it. I got arrested a lot before I ever picked up a drug. I was only 12, but I got arrested for burglary, criminal mischief, breaking and entering, arson, destruction of government property, vandalism. I was the first 13 members. I was one of the first 13 members of the Scared Straight program in Florida. And I had to go to Stark Prison. My dad walked out after my mom died, and we were abused a lot. We got beaten until we bled all over our bodies, my sister, my little brother, and me. So we had to wear turtlenecks and long sleeves, long pants. It was rough. We got out of that house. My sister ran away and went to another home. My older brother had left quite some time before. My little brother didn't really speak because he had brain damage in the car accident. So when I was sexually assaulted at a young age, I couldn't talk to anybody about it. You know, the people that were in the house were the people that hurt me. My little brother couldn't speak, and my family was all gone. Everybody was gone. So I didn't know anybody. And by the time I got down to the bus stop, when I woke up in the morning, I remembered everything. Started screaming, no sound would come out of my mouth. By the time I got down to the bus stop, I forgot. I forced myself to eliminate the memory from my mind. I didn't remember till I was 17, but I started using after I got arrested. And when I got out of Scared Straight, I decided to figure out how to not get caught. And it was neat the first time I started using. It was in St. Augustine. Actually, the very first time wasn't so neat. I drank fuzzy navels and orange juice with I ran away from home. My dad got us back. I ran away from home. And I was like, Dad, when do you want me back? And he's like, you can't come home. So the cops came and got me because I started fighting with them physically. And the cops came and got me, and I started punching this cop. And the cop let me punch him until I couldn't punch him anymore. And then he grabbed me and he hugged me. I mean, I was, what, you know, 75 pounds, you know? And he knew what was happening. He knew my dad wasn't letting me come home. And what he had to do at that point in time was walk with me around my neighborhood and let me knock on people's doors that I knew and ask permission for my father to pay them to keep me there. And the doors kept shutting, one right after the other. So I was pretty angry as a young person. I guess I should probably tell you a little prelude to that, too. When I got out of the house that I was getting abused at, we moved into a cop's home, and that police officer was really pretty structured. And he knew how to give us direction and guidance, and every time we got punished, we knew exactly why. So it made sense. And I really liked it there. I got to shoot lots of guns, 1903 A3 Springfields, assault rifle machine guns, Beretta 9mm. And I learned how to take them apart and put them back together. We did evasive and invasive tactics. We'd run 8 miles on Saturday. In the summers, we'd run 8 miles a day, every single day. I learned how to move without being seen and heard. We had BB gun wars where we'd shoot each other with BB guns. And I thought they were teaching me how to kill this woman that had abused me for so long. So I was planning my first murder when I was 11 years old. She died, incidentally, while I was at that home. And I was really sad that she died because I didn't get the chance to kill her. But that was my frame of mind at that point in time. Hey, Jimmy. The father that did so well with us there ended up cheating on my foster mom. And my dad had gotten remarried to the granddaughter of the dictator of Chile. No shit. Augusto Pinochet's granddaughter was now my stepmom. And my dad came and picked us up in Virginia. He was down here in Florida. He came and picked us up, and he said, "You're going to like your new mom." And he turned on the stereo and didn't talk to us for the 16 hours remaining in the car ride all the way home. And that really made me angry, extremely angry. So that's when I started getting arrested and stuff all the time. He didn't really talk to us the year and a half that we were there. So every time I saw her, I was like, you know, everything that I could say bad about her, I hated her. And I hated him. And I'd throw pots at him and hit him with pool balls. And I was just really angry, you know. He didn't care what happened to us and he wouldn't talk to us. So I started to act out. And when they arrested me, they pulled me out of class. There was a criminal psychiatrist, there were three board members from the school board, the principal, two arresting officers, a detective, and me, and they sit me down in this round table chamber, and they say, "We're going to arrest you," and they name the charges, and then the criminal psychiatrist said, "You have to work with me extensively from this point forward, because you fit the profile of a serial killer, and this is an intervention on your life. We're going to keep you from becoming what your life has designed you to become." And I didn't even like killing ants. I mean, I could scream at my dad, you know, but I wasn't like, you know, break cats in half or saw birds up or, you know, anything like that, you know, which was what I thought, you know, that type of, you know. So whatever, that's what they thought, and but I started getting high, you know, right after I got off probation and finished working with her. And what was really neat about, I ran away from home, my dad wouldn't let me come home, I punched him a bunch of times, and he hugged me. And then, it was really more like slamming on his chest. And then they take me to this house, or I go walk up to my friend Jason's house, and his dad lets me in, fuzzy navels and orange juice. And I get really sick really fast because it's really sweet. And my friend Jason said, "Oh, that's all right, man. All you got to do is puke, and then you can drink more." You know? And that was my real first night of drinking. On that street was A Street and St. Augustine. I used to drink during the day I'd skip school and drink, and I'd hide in the bushes. And the cars would drive really slow up that road because they were going to go down onto the beach. And I would jump out of the bushes and, like, jump in front of the cars or hit my head on the car and act like the car hit me, you know? And then they'd come give me attention and say they were sorry or whatever, and sometimes they'd buy me lunch, you know, or sometimes they'd be like, you're drunk, what the hell is wrong with you, you know? That's kind of what happened. I was there for a little bit. Meanwhile, I hadn't seen my sister in a long time. Okay, but she was in Florida. My dad had thrown her out before we got there. And I'm in my friend Jason's house. It was an evening time. His dad's mad at me because we've been skipping school. And he's banging me up against the refrigerator. Just boom, 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 shaking me, smacking me. And my sister comes in, like, out of nowhere. Like, I haven't seen her in years. And she just, like, opens the door. What the hell are you doing to my brother? And starts smacking this guy around. And I'm like, holy cow, you know, my sister's always kind of been like that. She's amazing. She was the number one goalie in Virginia for the Boys League of Lacrosse. So if that gives you an idea how tough she is, she's a badass. Anyways, so I leave there that night and go to this other friend's house and of my sister's. And I stay in there and just kind of play video games and didn't talk to anybody for 2 weeks until my brother came and got me. My brother drove up from St. Augustine. He was 21. And he picks me up and he's like, have you ever gotten high before? And I was like, yeah. And I hadn't really. I mean, I'd eaten acid once, but I'd never really smoked any pot. Well, anyways, I smoked pot that day with him, and it was fantastic because when I smoked, I knew how he felt. And I knew he knew how I felt. And I hadn't had that connection with somebody before. You know, I was the odd man out wherever I was. People hadn't been through what I'd been through. Kids didn't experience what I had experienced. So it felt really good. And I got to his house, and 3 days later, I found a bunch of acid in his house, and I sold all of it, and I thought I was supposed to become a drug dealer. That's what my lot in life was now. And so I did that. I jumped into it. I started dealing drugs. And within a year, I was selling drugs to my brother's drug dealers. Because I was young and I could travel really easily around the city and nobody would ever question anything. And I had no parents. And I had a 4-foot bong at home. So nobody, you know what I mean? Like, there was no way, nothing to stop me, you know? And I just did it. 2.5 years after that, well, let me back up. About 6 months after I got to my brother's house, my father died, killed himself drinking. I'd flown through the windshield of a car a few weeks before he died. And then a week after that happened, my brother told me to do the dishes. I said I didn't want to. So he said, you got to put on the gloves. And my brother was like 6'4". And I was like, I'll put on the gloves. I will kick your ass, you know. So I put on the gloves. And my brother broke my nose again. I wouldn't stop. I kept getting up, and he kept knocking me down and knocking me down. And so my dad came to take me to the deposition to meet with the lawyers and stuff. And they said because I had gotten into a boxing match after the accident that they couldn't help me any longer because they couldn't determine what was there first or whatever. And so my dad dropped me on the side of the road, and the last thing my dad said to me is, you're a worthless son of a bitch. I hope I never see you again. And he didn't. 2 weeks later, he was dead. I got off the bus. I remember walking up towards my house, and I was 200 yards from my house, and I knew. Nobody told me. I just knew, you know, he's dead. And I remember I'm dragging my books up the sidewalk, and my brother came to the door to meet me. And I looked up at him, and he's like, he could tell that I knew already or something. And he kind of looked at me strange. He goes, your father's dead. We had different fathers, same mom. So I got really wasted that night, screamed like crazy. Some reason when you're really sad, ecstasy has that kind of effect on you. I thought that would be the solution to my problems. I hated my dad. I hated him with a passion. Just short term after that, I saw a man and his son walking through my apartment complex on the sidewalk, and I was drunk. And I went up between them, and I separated the two of them from each other. And I told this kid that his dad didn't love him, and that if he ever told him it, it was all bullshit. And, you know, there's something wrong with this whole life and all this stuff. And the dad grabs the kid, and he's not mad at me. He's not frustrated. He just looks at me kind of like, what happened to you? You know, I don't understand. And it was like he wanted to help me, but he wanted to get his son as far away from me as he could. So he left. I did a lot of dangerous hallucinogens that I sought from places like Africa and stuff like that. And I got them, and a lot of people died doing them with different mixtures. And I would be catatonic for 3 days where... My brother said my eyes were open, and he's shaking me and yelling at me in my face, and I'm walking around, but I can't hear or see anybody. I did lots of hallucinogenics and stuff like that, and got pretty deep into the dealing thing, and then I got really sick because I wasn't eating any food. I would eat garlic knots and a bag of beans and rice that I would cook on Thursday, and I would get high until Tuesday, and then I'd pass out and wake up on Thursday, and then I would eat some garlic knots and a bag of beans and rice. So I was eating one meal a week, and that went on for about 7 months, and I was ingesting a lot of heroin, crystal meth, PCP, and I know there's a lot of drugs in my story, but ultimately it gets back to the alcohol. But my leg shrunk significantly compared to my other leg. I was very, very sick on my bed, and I would stand up and I'd try to go to the bathroom or something, and as soon as I would stand up, I'd get tunnel vision and it would get black and everything would just kind of disappear. And then I would fall and I would wake up with convulsions on the ground, and I'd pull myself back into bed and I'd lay there, and as soon as I would go to sleep, it would be like I'd stop breathing, and I was afraid, and I couldn't breathe, and I didn't know what would happen, and then I'd start convulsing again. And I remember crawling from my bed to the kitchen. It could have taken an hour, could have taken 2 days. I have no idea, but I called my aunt and uncle on the phone, and I said, I think I need some help. And my aunt and uncle said, well, we've been thinking about you, you know, and we thought... Well, you know what, let me call you back in a couple minutes. I want to talk to your Uncle Bob about something, and I'm going to call you back. And I said, okay. And they had no idea what I was like or what I'd been through or that I was even an addict and an alcoholic at this point in time. But they get back, they call me back, and I answer the phone, and they said, we want to send you across Prince William Sound to kayak with the National Outdoor Leadership School. And I said, that would be great. That's exactly what I need, you know. I need that, you know. And they're like, well, it just so happens your cousin is in Tampa, and he can come by this afternoon and pick you up. And I said, awesome. That's awesome, you know. Well, I'm wearing clothes that I've probably been wearing for like a month. You know, my house, under my bed is a bunch of cockroaches. You know, you peel it back and there's cockroaches there. I mean, I'm an addict's addict, you know, and my cousin comes, and he sees me, and he is, like, nervous as hell all of a sudden, and he helps me get out to the car, literally carries me out to the car, walking with him on, and I'm just talking to him about National Outdoor Leadership School, and how I'm going to do this, and this is going to be the greatest thing for my life, you know, blah, blah, blah. And he's on the phone with my aunt and uncle and tells them the situation or whatever. And then I get there and I start going into seizure withdrawals right away. They take me to the hospital. In the hospital, they do an MRI on me and they find that I have a tumor in my leg. And so shortly after that, I'm out at Shands with Dr. Scarborough, and he's cutting my leg open and taking the tumor out of my leg. And when I woke up from that, the doctor came in and he said, there's enough. He goes, let me tell you what happened to you, okay? He said, you have calcium deficiency throughout your entire body. you have been ingesting chemicals so much into your body that your digestive system has shut down. Your body is using your bone marrow as a filtration system to break down the chemicals that you're ingesting, trying to find a way to help you remove these chemicals from your body. Where you have a calcium deficiency in your leg, the chemicals have started to build up and eat through your bone, and we removed the mass, and there's enough elements in this mass for me to make the chemical composition for pills or medicine. And I said, hand it here. If he had given it to me, I would have eaten it. I swear to God, I would have eaten it. I went to a mental institution pretty quickly after that. I had somebody 24 inches away, 24 hours a day from me, and I loved it. If I was anything, you know what 16-year-old boys do, you know? Anything I did, they were there, you know? And I was, you know, if I peed, if I pooped, if I took a shower, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I hated that they were there, and I didn't want them to leave. A girl tried to stab herself five times, or did stab herself five times in the arm with a pen, and then came at me and tried to stab me with it, and I was blocking, and no one was moving to help me. Everybody was in shock. Everybody was in shock. And so I broke her nose, and then they came and they put me on a papoose board and shot me up with Thorazine and put me in a rubber room. And I'm like, why me, you know? And then I started feeling guilty afterwards, but I got out of there. It took 16 weeks or 19 weeks, and I got out of there, and I started going to meetings, and I got sober for about 7 months, and I started calling old drug dealers, you got to come to meetings, this is amazing, you know, I really thought that I had the answers. Anyways, I drank half a beer. They told me that if I did, I'd be out, and I said, but I told you, I didn't drink the whole beer. I stopped. I came back, you know. And they said, no, you're done. You're out of here. There's no second chances. You're out. And there was an apartment right next door that they let me rent, helped me rent. And I had some money coming in because my father had died. And so I got monthly checks. And so that paid the rent there. And then I used my way out of there. And then I got jumped by like four dudes. And then I wound up in a homeless shelter. And then I couldn't abide by the homeless shelter rules. And then I'm out on the corner with a sign saying, we'll work for food. I need a place, you know, da da da. Then this gay guy picks me up and takes me to his house. And, you know, I let him do stuff to me in exchange for crack. And then I find this girl. I get a job. I find this girl at work and say, I'm in a gay dude's house and I don't know what the hell's going on, but I'm smoking too much crack and I need to get out of there. Then I move into there, and then, well, it was bad because I got dropped off at that house, and then the neighbor's like, you got to crawl around onto the deck to get in there. So I crawl around onto the deck to get in there, and I knock on the window and I look in, and then they're making out, and that was not good, like, way to open, you know, to... Then one of them's like a really angry lesbian who's just got knocked up and boyfriend left, and they start telling me that I need to wash my body more than I did, and then I leave there, and I found these people that needed some drugs, and then I found my connections, and then I got back into that racket, and before I know it, I'm on my way to do a home invasion, and we know they're at home, and we have, you know, a dozen weapons, 200 or 300 rounds of ammo. They're definitely going to be there. We got hog ties. We got duct tape. This isn't our first rodeo. And we get hit by a car. And we take all the guns, and we had a couple grams of heroin, and we take all the drugs, and we stash them in a roof just like this inside this restaurant right there before the cops show up. And I told them to tell them my name was Joshua Aaron Bond, the brother that I had at the cop's house. Because I know his social security number, his date of birth, his parents' names, his birthplace. I know everything about him. But they told the cop before I got back from the restaurant, stash and everything, that I was Dave King. And I had a warrant out for my arrest for failure to appear in court on a suspended license because I left my car on the side of the road and never picked it up again. And that's, you know, you get a ticket for that, and then you don't pay the ticket, and then you get, you know, whatever. So I went to jail for 2 weeks, and I'm in jail, and I'm happy to be in jail. And I'm thinking to myself, why the hell am I happy to be in jail? You know, I don't want to be in jail. What am I doing? And then it dawned on me, you know, maybe I would have killed somebody, or maybe I would have been killed, or maybe I'd be spending the rest of my life in prison today if this didn't happen. And I felt like someone was looking out for me. And I always kind of had that feeling, like, my mom and dad could have died for no reason. Everything I've been through didn't happen to me for no reason. There's got to be some reason that I'm alive. There's got to be some reason that, you know, something could happen. Incidentally, when I was in that mental institution, there was a psychotherapy circle, and a girl was talking about when she was raped, and she said the same words her perpetrator used were the same words that were used on me. And I was 16 at that time, and that's when I remembered it. And I remembered it because a shooting pain went from my butt to my head, and it hurt so bad that I was in a fetal position on the ground. But I couldn't admit that it actually really happened there. I thought that it did. It took some time, but I wanted to let you guys know, because that's a vital part of my recovery later. But I'm in jail. I'm wondering why. I'm killing everybody in there in chess. I mean, I am murdering people in chess. I didn't even know I was that good at chess. And I was carving all the pieces out of soap. I was having a great time. We were telling jokes. There was like, we were stacked three high in the cells and just laughing all night. I mean, I was like, this is like the best time ever. The food was even good. And it's the worst food, you know. Three hots and a cot. I needed it. And I decided when I was in jail that I was never going to deal drugs again, and I never did. And I got out, and I was behind a garbage can on Kennedy Boulevard in Arowana, right at that little metro station, I forget. And my sister drove from St. Augustine and picked me up behind there and helped me get it, actually, when we went up there, they had just moved into Jacksonville, and I started screaming and yelling, you know, every day at them. I hated her husband. He was like a poor podunk, redneck, that was everything I could say about him. And I hated him. And they just bought this trailer. It was like their first place, and it was brand new. And 2 weeks after I got there, they left. And it went up to foreclosure, you know, and I'm lucky he didn't kill me, but she loved me very much, and I was a mess, and so I thought the thing to do was leave the country. So I got my passport and got some friends together, and I moved to Costa Rica, grew dreadlocks and a beard, praised Haile Selassie, and one of my friends was like, I led you out of Babylon into Zion, let's get old together and fuck each other's wives, excuse my language. And I was like, no way, I'm not doing that. You didn't save anybody, you know? What is wrong with you? So I left Costa Rica, I hitchhiked home, hitchhiked across Costa Rica, flew to Miami, then hitchhiked from Miami to Tampa. Ended up in this crazy ass house with this guy that was wild. I mean, I was his neighbor, I rented from him. But he would like tap on my window with a bowling pin and like say really vile stuff, and I was like freaking out. So I worked at Bernini at the time and at the Olive Garden, and I went to Jason, the manager at Bernini. This was the second time I worked at Bernini, incidentally. But I went to Jason, the manager at Bernini, and I said, I need to get out of where I'm at. This isn't working. So he moved me into his house. And he liked to party a lot, so we started partying a lot together. And I started working really hard at Bernini. I was very angry, you know. I remember the chef used to come to work with a bullpup Mini 14 machine gun. And every time I'd talk to him with a knife in my hand, he'd put his hand on the machine gun and be like, Dave, put down the knife. You know, that was just the type of person that I was. I really was angry at everybody. I didn't like anybody. I didn't get along with people. I tried to be nice, but when you try to get close, you know, it was just really bad. I went to a game with all these guys. It was a New York versus Phillies. Yankees versus the Phillies. And I'm a Phillies fan. And we were three rows behind the Phillies behind home plate or four rows. And every time the Phillies would get a Yankee out, I'd turn around. I was really drunk, and I'd scream at the crowd, "Yank this!" You know, and I that's just who I was. I mean, and I'd screamed it over and over, like seven innings. And then during the moment of silence for Joe DiMaggio, who had just died, I screamed out, "Joe DiMaggio sucks!" as loud as I could. And everybody that was there with me left when I went to the bathroom. And when I came back from the bathroom, everybody in the stands was like, "Ha ha, they left your ass." And I'm like, "Man, they didn't leave me." And then I start walking out, and they're all laughing right outside. And they take me across the street to the Pink Pony and give me $500 and $1 bills and told me to sit in front of the stage and don't move. So I didn't have any consequences for my actions, you know. I was just really violent. But very rapidly, after years of drinking and stuff, working at Bernini, my phone, people didn't invite me around anymore. They didn't want me to hang out. And I didn't really like myself. And I tried to get sober because I had remembered the meetings and I came, and I was there for 7 months. I even worked the first four steps with Guy. But I couldn't admit that I was a real alcoholic. This is just my thinking, you know. I'd go into meetings and I'd say, "Why do you guys want to quit? I mean, look how many of us there are. Let's just teach each other how to drink right, you know. There's no reason to give it up forever. I mean, what are we going to become? Who am I going to be, you know?" But who was I already? I mean, I had absolutely nothing to offer anybody. And I wasn't very happy. As a matter of fact, a lot of times my communication was non sequitur. My sentences didn't follow an order with each other. And I remember a guy kicking me at Starbucks, telling me to get the hell away from me. I remember my brother telling me, "Dave, your communication is non sequitur." That's how I learned that word. You know, he was like, "You're not making any sense, dude. You know, there's no chronological order to what you're saying to me, you know." And I was pretty embarrassed, but I couldn't admit that I was an alcoholic. And so I went out and used again on February 24th of 2000 on my birthday. And I went to the Hyde Park Cafe every single night because I lived four blocks from the Hyde Park Cafe in a studio apartment for $390 a month. And every single night at Hyde Park Cafe, I'd be the first guy on the dance floor, and I'd dance with my eyes closed. And when I opened up my eyes, there'd be a group of people dancing around me going, like, "Hell yeah." And then I'd go to the bar, and I would drink two drinks. And then I'd sit on the bar stool, and I'd look around at everybody in there, and I'd think to myself, "Don't offer me a drink. Don't ask me to buy you a drink. Don't ask me what I'm drinking. Don't ask me to drink with you." You know? And I basically was scared. And then I'd maybe dance a little bit more, and the bar would close, and I'd be angry that the bar was closing, and I did that every single night. And I wouldn't get home until 3:30. Sometimes I'd take weird-ass women home with me, and I wouldn't get to sleep until 5:30. And then I'd wake up at 7 in the morning to go to school or to get my work, you know, situation up and running again. And I thought that I was successful. I did opium once. I did mushrooms once, I smoked pot once, and I thought that I was being successful. And I did that every single day, every single night, for 7 months. And I didn't get drunk. Until I'm in my car, and it doesn't start. And I'm like, shit. And I'm right out in front of my house. And I got to go to school. And that night I got to go to work. And so I'm angry and I lock my keys in the car, and I had locked myself out of my house, and there was a pot on the stove with boiling water, and I knew I was going to get kicked out of the honors program, which I had actually gotten myself into while I was sober. And I was like, what the hell am I going to do, you know? And then I knew I was going to lose my job because I delivered pizzas and I didn't have any money to fix my car. I didn't have any idea what was wrong with it. And right at that moment, my phone rang, and it was my buddy, Deli. And he was like, "My wife just cheated on me." And I said, come on over. And he got there, and I was like, one quart. We'll just have one quart, because I'm not getting screwed up. And I broke a window in my car to get the keys out to get into my house. And we went and got one quart. And I woke up on Sunday, and I had ripped the appliances out of the wall where I was living in a rented apartment. I had written a bad check at every single suite. Well, it was cash and carry and Winn-Dixie and Publix that I could. And that was before they had the check readers, you know, to get the $25 or the $35. So not only was I without a job and out of the honors program, I had, you know, committed a crime, several of them, and I had overdrawn my accounts, and I looked in the mirror. I was certain that would never happen to me again. And it was weird because the thing that came out of my mouth was, there's something wrong with your constitution, when I looked myself in the mirror. And that made a lot of sense to me, you know. I didn't know how to live. And the way that I chose to live, what I thought was okay with me, was to make my life worse when it was bad. And I looked back over my life, and I had done it over and over and over and over. That's what I did. I knew how to do that. I didn't know how to do anything else. I didn't know how to be a friend. I didn't know how to get involved with people. I didn't know how to think. I didn't know how to read and write really well. Anyways, I'd failed 10th grade three times and somehow got myself into college, and I wanted to get my school back together, and I got desperate, and I went to a meeting on September 24th of 2000, and I got a sponsor there named Jeb. He was a little bit shorter than me, and I didn't think he was going to be my sponsor. He asked me to take him, if he could take me home, and I said, yeah. And I get in the car, and I start telling him, I want to get sober, I'm going to do this, and he screams at me, shut the f*** up. I don't want to hear anything you got to say. Nothing. Shut up. And I looked at him like, he doesn't know me. He doesn't know that I got nothing to lose. He doesn't know that I am a ferocious 140-pound crazy man, you know? I'm bigger than you, you know. But I looked at him, and I had respect for him instantly. Instantly. This is a guy that I need to talk to. You know, this is a guy that knows something I don't know. You know? And he put me on step one, two, and three pretty quick. And for 6 months, I danced on one, two, and three. 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 And I complained, when am I going to have a car? Because I drove the bus a lot. And when am I going to have a cell phone with numbers in it? You know, when am I going to have a better looking girlfriend or any girlfriend at all? When am I going to make more money? When am I going to this and this, everything, nothing, you know? And I'd, in my head, like, I'd have conversations with my boss at the kitchen, with other servers that were there, with people. I would imagine I'm going to get fired. All of this stuff going on, and I hated it. I remember getting on the bus one day, and this lady had 13 children. I've never had a kid, and I'm giving her advice on how to take care of her kids, you know, and with such grace she handled it, and she was appreciative and nice to me and thanked me for the advice, you know. What the, you know what I mean? But I was a wreck. I was a mess, and I didn't understand, and I, you know, I remember calling him in the... I lived in a little apartment on Westland Avenue. And inside of the building, there's apartments on each side of this hallway. And so it's like a hotel, kind of. And I sold drugs and got drugs from the guy at the end of my building. And I was close to him. We were friends. And the first 2.5 years of my sobriety, I lived in that building. Steps away from being able to get a drink or a drug for free anytime I wanted to. And I'd hear him at night. And I remember in the first few months of my sobriety, rocking on my chair, looking at the TV with the fuzzies on it, and then my phone right in front of it, going to myself, I don't want to get high. I'm not going to drink. I'm not going to pick up. I don't want to. It's not going to happen. You know, I wish they would shut up. I wish they would shut up. You know, and then I would grab the phone as soon as I couldn't take it anymore. And my sponsor, Jeb, answered the phone all the time, like 2 in the morning, 3 in the morning, 4:30 in the morning, you know. And he'd say, let's play the tape through. Let's hear what you got, you know. Let's talk about it. What are you doing? Where do you want to go? What do you want to do? Do you really want to go back to what you had before? Blah, 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 blah. And then I'd complain to him, and sometimes he'd be like, that's it. I remember calling him 2 times in 1 minute, you know. Please, you know, and he answered the phone. He always answered the phone. Always. And finally, he screamed at me again. And one of my, wah, 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 poor me, why can't I, wah, wah, wah. And he screamed at me, shut the, you know what I mean. And he goes, you're not allowed to call me anymore. I'm like, what? You know, what? Yeah, you're not allowed to call me anymore if you're going to talk to me about your problems. I don't want to hear anything you got to say. Nothing. You can call me and tell me you're alive and you're sober, and I want you to hang up the phone because I don't want to hear another word you got coming out of your mouth. Or you can call me and tell me that you finished the work I've given to you and you're ready for more. And then he got off the phone. And I was an egomaniac with an inferiority complex. I didn't want to call him up and say I'm alive, you know. I want him to listen. I wanted him to be my, you know, my mom and my dad, you know. I needed him to be my friend. I needed him to listen to me and hear me bitch and moan and complain. And I got on the phone, and I called him back, and I said, okay, I'm going to do the work that you told me to do. And I want to get started right now. And he said, okay, now listen to me. If you do this work, all your problems are going to be solved. And I said, I'm not tall enough, dude. You're not going to make me taller. I've already grown all I'm going to grow. And he was like, trust me. If you do all of these steps with everything you got, balls to bone, everything you got, all of it, you got to give it all up. All your problems will be solved. And not only will all your problems be solved, all your dreams are going to come true. And I said, huh? I hadn't even thought about a dream. Like a dream? Whoa, you know, bullshit. You know, like I get to dream. I didn't have any plans. I didn't even know, you know. I was in school, but... He said, I want you to come up with a dream, and I don't want you to come up with, you know, you're going to win the World Series of Poker this year, or you're going to go to the strip club and get 3 strippers to come home with you, and they're all going to fall in love with each other and you, and you're going to live happily ever after, you know? And I was like, well, then there's nothing else worth living for. No. And he was like, but I want you to come up with something realistic, you know, something that you can attain. I want you to do something. Think of something that you would like that would make you happy. And I want you to call me back right away. And so I got off the phone, I thought about it, and the best thing I could come up with was a freezer full of meat and a grill. And I called him back and I said, I want a freezer full of meat and a grill. And he goes, dude, that is perfect. Because there is no room in your apartment for a freezer, and you're not allowed to have a grill where you live. And he's like, you got a long way to go, but we're going to get there. You know, we're going to get there. And so I started working those steps. And right in about midway to my 4th step, just a few weeks later, I got really upset. And I was in a restaurant, and this guy comes up, and he's all got his 2 girls around on each side. And he's like, I'm going to go make a porn. And I'm like... thinking to myself, I'm going to go kill somebody and shoot up with heroin until I die. And then I start thinking about how I'm going to do it. I'm going to, you know, hitchhike. I'm going to get in the back seat. And then at a red light, I'm going to break their neck. And then I'm going to push them out of the car. Then I'm going to drive their car into the dope hole. I'm going to sell it at the chop shop I know. And I'm going to take the $400 or $600. And I'm going to go buy 10 packs of heroin. And I'm going to shoot it all at the same time and die. And I looked over and this guy, Wes, was standing right there. And Wes is huge, man. And I was like, Wes, how do you know God's real? And Wes said, think of all the times your friends died next to you and you didn't die, and that was God looking out for you. And I got mad. I'm like, why would God choose me over my friends? You know, that's disgusting, you know? Like, what is that about, you know? And then I got angry, and I wanted to fight him. And so I went at him like I was going to fight him. And he stands with his arms open like this, and he grins at me, you know? And he's like, God needs you. He loves you. You are part of him. He is part of you. And as he says that to me, all my anger kind of just left, you know? And I'm looking at him, and that same kind of love that you feel from your mom the first time that you ride your bike without training wheels, and you run inside, and instead of telling her, she hands you a dish and a towel and expects you to start drying, and you want to tell her. You want to tell her, but she's already seen you, you know? And then she just looks down at you, and she doesn't have to say a thing. And you're both drying the dishes together, and she knows, and then that energy starts to go between both of you. And there's this love, this connection, this joy, this power. And I saw that, but it was weird because I saw it in his arms and his legs and the floor and the walls and the pots that were hanging from the ceiling. And I was engulfed in love. Everything was grinning at me. And I fell down to the ground, and I'm looking up at him on all fours, and I can't talk. And I can't hear anything that's happening anymore. And he's talking to me, and it's like, you know, and I'm overwhelmed. And I crawl out of this restaurant, which was 42nd Street Bistro at the time, and I lived right behind that. And I try to smoke a cigarette. A cigarette doesn't even taste good anymore. And I crawl home, and anyways, I only got a few more minutes, so I'll sum up this part of the story. I ended up saying thank you that night 10,000 times for everything that had ever happened to me in my life. I said thank you for hours. Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. And I forgave my father and my mother, and I had an experience that night that relieved all of my anger. I talked to my father. I heard my father speak to me and say, you never, you know, you didn't see me go into the light. What you saw was a burden being lifted off of my shoulders. I'm always going to be right here with you. And I heard my mom say to me, and I was a predator to women. I mean, I tried to be everything to a woman all at once, a caretaker, provider, best friend, lover, entertainer. And if she didn't sleep with me in the same day, then I didn't call her again because she rejected me. And I scared the shit out of every girl that I ever met. And my mom said to me that night, don't worry about women, I got it all taken care of. And since then, I've been able to back off and lighten up and slow down. And a lot of things have happened. I mean, I've learned so much, and I'm continuing to learn so much since that night. But my anger lifted, and I knew that I wasn't cured, but I knew that I had found my higher power. And I knew that I couldn't ever deny that that was my experience and that it was real. And so I jumped into the steps and I got busy. And when I started doing the fifth step, I realized that this was something that I would never do on my own. It wasn't the type of, you know, thing that I could be creative enough to come up with. I wasn't well enough to establish that. And I knew I had a long way to go to understand more about this love that I had just experienced. And so I worked hard, and I worked on my ninth step for about 7.5 years. It took me to pay all my debts. And I moved to Mexico for a year in the meantime to study abroad. And I learned to speak Spanish, and I fell in love, which was weird because I never thought that would happen. And then we broke up, and that hurt for quite some time. I moved to Europe. Shortly after I graduated from University of Tampa, top of the class with a degree in international business. And I taught English in Barcelona and in Germany. And then I came back, bought my business over again, started it up, sold it. I had a very successful automotive detailing business through school. And then I sold it again. And 7.5 years I'm finishing up my amends that I worked really hard on. I have some lifelong amends that will keep me sober, hopefully, for a long time. But the reverend of my church, Harmony, came outside, and she said, David, you've done enough. You don't have to. You finished. You know, you don't owe anybody anything anymore. And I sat on the back of my truck, and I looked up at the sky, and I said, all right, God, you know, I'd like to continue to see the world. I don't know how I'm going to pay for it. If you want me to stay here and run this business and keep this business, I'd love to do that. But I think that my mind is amazing. You've shown me that I'm really gifted and smart, and I'd like to do something with it. And if I could have my own renewable energy company in a few years, I'd like to do that too. My sponsor told me to dream and dream big. And he said that when my dream came true and I got my grill and I got my freezer full of meat, that I'd have to dream new dreams. And then I went to the University of Tampa on a full scholarship, and I have to dream new dreams. And I went to Mexico, and I finished my amends, and I went to counseling, and I dealt with my sexual trauma, and I had post-traumatic stress disorder, so I did EMDR. I went for years, and I became well, and I became sane, and I became happy. And the day after I asked God for that request, my phone rang. And a friend of mine was in Madrid, and he said, Dave, you need to send your resume to the CEO of our company. And within 7 days, I was flown to Madrid to compete for a position as a kind of a reporter. But what I did is I simulated information, and I gave it to reporters to write the stories, journalists. So I was more of an editor. But I won that position. And I flew back, and I got off the plane, and my phone rang before I got out of the airport. And the same guy that I sold my business to a few years before said, hey, are you selling your business again? I'd like to buy it. I got cash. And I said, yeah. And I sold it to him right there. And I went home, and I put everything I owned on Craigslist, and it sold in 4 hours. I had a Mercedes. I had televisions, computers, I had couches, beds. I mean, it all sold like that. And within 3 weeks, I was in Lisbon, Portugal, and I was interviewing the Prime Minister of Portugal for Forbes magazine. And I interviewed all the heads of the entire country and the leaders in the country and the sectors that mattered most, mostly IT. And then I did the same thing in Montreal, Quebec, Canada. And then I did the same thing in Lagos, Nigeria for the Times of London. And while I was in Lagos, I stopped doing that, and I started working on a indigenous natural gas project to stop flaring in the Niger Delta, which has caused a lot of issues. And I found another company that had created peace with the Ogoni people amongst themselves. They were a U.S.-based securities firm, and I joined them up. And what we tried to do wasn't accomplished, but 22,000 militants in the Niger Delta received amnesty. And I lived with the head of the militant armies alone for 5 months. The chief of staff to the president gave me a car and a driver, and I spent time with him every single day. I worked close with the chief justice of the Supreme Court there, and it was remarkable. I mean, I never, ever thought. I started a meeting there. They didn't have meetings. And I started a meeting there. My first sponsee's name was Godwin. And when Godwin read the book, we met a week after I got the books in from World Service. We met a week later. And he said, he's an Igbo guy that grew up in a tribal village. English was not his first language. The culture that we have here is very different from the one that they had there while he was growing up. He was in war territories, completely different person than me. And when he read that book, he came back and said, I feel like you guys have been spying on me. How do you know so much, you know? Anyways, I'm back in Tampa. I'm still working on some stuff in Africa and South Sudan now. My little brother is living in my house. He just moved in 3 months ago. They're victims of a human labor trafficking thing last year. He has a mental disability. His wife has a physical disability. And I'm teaching them how to budget and how to work. And I have a company that's providing them with a stable income and place to live. And that's remarkable. My sister wants me around. Every time I leave, she asks me when I'm coming back. You know, this program does everything. In every country I've ever lived in, this was always a priority. So I had people in my room at my hotel from a meeting working steps. And I did it every single night from 7 until 1, Monday to Thursday. Friday, Saturday, Sunday, I kept to myself. I had translators in some countries that volunteered their time to translate for me at meetings. There was French in Canada, but a lot of them spoke English and Portuguese in Lisbon. So, anyways, I'm really grateful that you guys came tonight, and I'm grateful that I'm here sober. It's an amazing life, so if you're new, I mean, if you heard my story, you know that weird things can happen to you that aren't supposed to happen, and amazing things will happen to you if you let God have control. You know, it's just out of your hands. You got to let it happen. So thanks. That's all I got.
David Kay.